From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is Caitlin Ugalik Phillips, who has written The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. In her new book, Phillips shares her own personal stories as well as those of doctors, entrepreneurs, teachers, journalists, and scientists, all about moving innovation and technology forward without succumbing to isolation. This book is for anyone interested in how our brains work, how they're subtly being rewired to work differently, and what that ultimately means for us as humans. Caitlin, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I think what we're feeling at this point is we are disillusioned as a culture, as a society, really globally, about how our technology, how social media is working for us in terms of how we're interacting or not with other humans. What are the shortcomings that made you write this book?
I definitely agree. And I had a lot of personal experiences where I felt, I had a lot of experiences where I felt that social media helped me connect with people. And I do still have those experiences, but a few years ago, I started to really notice exactly what you're describing, that the sort of filter of social media seemed to be kind of getting in the way of the empathy that is required for, you know, really good conversations and relationships. And in the book, I mentioned that while I think social media has helped us build bridges with other people, it's also contributed to, you know, our ability to burn them quickly and spectacularly.
Well, and a big part of that is because what we're seeing is a marked lack of empathy out there on social media, in on the social media world, and specifically in, I would say, comments. You know, you talk a lot about trolling and, there was another word that you used in there, doxing, is it?
Yes, that is when someone publishes your personal information, like your phone number or your address, online.
Right. And so, you know, we're seeing things that people are saying online, especially in the comment section, that they never would say to your face. I think a certain portion of the population thinks that there's a lot of freedom in that, that it's liberating them to get off their chest what they've really wanted to say all along. What is the danger in that that you see?
Well, I think there's danger both to the person who's doing that and the people that they're doing it to. So, I think that one thing that people don't tend to realize is that if they are doing something like that to someone, a stranger, they're probably not the only one. So a lot of times you'll hear people say, you know, just ignore it, just block people. But their trolls tend to come in large groups. There's often not only one person. So you kind of end up being part of a pylon. But also, you know, it doesn't, I mean, I can't say that I've trolled people, but, you know, sometimes when you say something off the cuff without really thinking about how it's going to affect the other person and you just kind of dash off the comment and hit enter, it doesn't feel good for you either. You know, it doesn't resolve anything. You probably have now started a conversation that's going to be ongoing for hours, if not days. And I just think that taking a moment to kind of think, what am I actually adding to this conversation and how am I going to feel and how might that other person feel, can really, you know, have a benefit.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Caitlin Ugalik Phillips. She has written The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. I absolutely agree with you. We need empathy, and we need it bad. One of the challenges, I think, is that people don't listen, and they're so concerned about getting their points across, and they're so entrenched in their view that they just don't listen. And listening goes along with empathy. How do we specifically get people to actually listen to the other person?
A good question, kind of a eternal question. I think that I guess one way to do that, and one way that I've been trying to do that in my life, especially after reporting this book, is to spend more time being more intentional and mindful about how I use technology, so that I think when you get wrapped up in constant scrolling, you can kind of forget that you're dealing with other humans, and you get kind of stuck on little niche issues and arguments that seem huge, but then if you take the time to step away, you can kind of put them more in perspective. So I think perspective is a big thing, you know, making sure that you are not, you know, that you are being mindful and intentional about the way that you communicate with each other and use technology. I also think that just being exposed to more people who aren't necessarily like you. So, you know, a lot of us curate our feeds about on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter for the things that we like. But I think that the more that we kind of follow people who aren't like us, and not necessarily to engage, but just kind of to observe and to see what their experience is like, you know, the more you can maybe build empathy for others' perspectives and maybe be more likely to listen when they have something to say.
And I very much enjoyed your chapter and your other pieces spread throughout the book on VR, virtual reality. And one of my original thoughts when I was thinking about virtual reality and empathy is that we're kind of moving towards, or virtual reality is moving towards, an avatar world where you're going to have someone representing you that may not have the facial ability to communicate, which is what you need for empathy. Do you think we can work around that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think that, I'm not sure about working around that. I do think that there are, you know, other ways to express empathy than, you know, with facial expressions. I mean, I do believe that it's possible to express empathy in, you know, text conversations and online in that way. But this is a really important thing that I think that the folks creating VR experiences are working on, is how individual avatars can connect with one another. And that's going to be really interesting to see going forward.
You know, Caitlin, I thought something that was so interesting I'd never thought about before is when you're talking to Siri or Alexa, that we don't say please and thank you. This is something you brought up. And, you know, where are we going with that? Wouldn't it be interesting if, John says he does say thank you to Alexa. That's nice. But where are we with those sorts of things that are sort of compelling us to use empathy with our technological interactions?
Yeah, it's really interesting. We don't really say please and thank you to Alexa, and yet we kind of treat her, it, as a person as well. You know, sometimes we refer to Alexa as she because she has a typically female name. So we are kind of in this weird limbo right now where we feel feelings and we kind of treat these avatars and algorithms and robots kind of as people. We sort of recognize them as human-like, but then we don't quite have empathy for them, and we don't quite, you know, recognize them as human. And so I think right now we're in that uncanny valley, right? But in places like Japan and other countries, and certain places in the U.S. as well, you are seeing more sort of lifelike robots kind of out and about in the world, and researchers are studying how people are interacting with them. I was just reading about a study where they put a robot with kind of a face in line at a coffee shop to see how people would respond, if they would cut in line or if they would just kind of assume, oh yeah, this robot's standing in line. So I think that, you know, there's kind of ongoing research in that area. We are kind of starting to get more comfortable with these bots, these creatures in our world, and we are just going to have to sort of adapt and learn how to do that in a way that is comfortable for us.
Oh, that's really interesting. Anthropomorphizing robots, and you talk about this a little bit. There was some sort of pilot experiment done where people were supposed to smash these cute little robot critters, and how they felt about doing it, and they felt like they had some reservation about it, which is good. That's good.
Yeah, well, people did it, but then they felt bad. They used words like, you know, I didn't want to kill the robot, and the robot was innocent. And it's like, well, it's you know, does it have agency? Are those things true? But those are the feelings. Those are real feelings that we have.
Walter Isaacson, who wrote the official biography of Steve Jobs, was on our program. And one of the things we were talking about was how Steve was very careful about the technology that his children were allowed to get involved in. And Steve's been gone now for a while. A lot has changed since Steve was here. What is going on in Silicon Valley now as far as executives or people within organizations that are also shielding their children from technology?
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I think that Tim Cook also has said that his nephew, he doesn't, you know, encourage to use
that's correct.
A smartphone. And there are others who are, you know, at the helm of some of these big tech organizations who say similar things, and that they themselves, you know, don't spend a lot of time using these technologies. I think that's a spot where going forward we can inject more empathy into the process of creating these technologies. I think that in some cases the folks who created these things didn't really, you know, look far enough into the future and into the perspectives of the people who might be using their tools who are different from them, who might have a harder time unplugging, I suppose. And I think that there is a growing movement in Silicon Valley to pull back a little bit and say, okay, whoa, we didn't mean for everyone to be doing this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it taking over your life. But at the same time, it's a business. So I was really heartened to see that a lot of the folks I spoke with for the book who are developing new technologies are trying to find ways to integrate empathy for future users and how the tech will affect them into their process of creation.
And interestingly, in your book, you talk about how we can use technology to build empathy and in turn use empathy to build technology. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So using empathy to build technology kind of is right along the lines of what I was just discussing, you know, being really mindful about how people might experience the tools you're using and how they might experience unintended consequences, really future thinking about what might someone who's not you, you know, be concerned about and what could go wrong. I think a part of that is having more diversity at the table in creating these tools. So diversity of experience, gender, race, income, ability, and then using technology to help build empathy. A virtual reality is one example that you brought up earlier. There's a lot of simulation capabilities, kind of perspective taking in a little bit more of a literal way. If you put on a headset and sort of see what it's like to be someone else. I don't think that it's a magic pill. It's not, you know, you don't suddenly know what it's like to be another person, but I think it can sort of awaken those empathy spots in your brain and kind of remind you how different other people's experiences might be. And then there are also things that are kind of in between those two ends of the coin, like chatbots that can moderate conversations online or sort of see when something's going to go off the rails. So I think that there's kind of a spectrum of ways that we are starting to integrate empathy with technology.
We're speaking with Caitlin Ugalik-Phillips. Her book is The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Chatbots and algorithms that control or that pick up, as you say, some, you know, when comments go awry, shall we say. How does that work? Is it just detecting some words that are those telltale signs of a conversation being derailed?
Mm-hmm. So far, what I have seen is that they take in tons and tons and tons of data from existing conversations and highlight certain words that have been deemed toxic or potentially disruptive to a conversation, and they determine that based on other surveys of what people consider to be toxic. So one of the interesting things about algorithms is that they are created by people, and they sort of consume data that is produced by people in order to make these machine learning decisions. So, you know, there is kind of a virtuous or vicious, however you want to look at it, cycle there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, some of these algorithms, they they take in these big data sets of words, and they flag ones that are considered to be toxic or disruptive, and then in a conversation they can, you know, pop up in some way, however they're designed to let you know. So, for example, the neighborhood social network Nextdoor has something called a kindness reminder, I think it's called. And if you use a word that has been flagged in the past as potentially being disruptive, it'll pop up and say exactly that. You know, your message is similar to ones that have been reported in the past. You know, are you sure you want to say this? Now, I will say that I got flagged recently because someone was asking about churches, and I mentioned a couple of different potential churches they could go to. And I think because I said words that describe religious affiliations, that in the past someone might have used those words in a negative connotation, and so it was flagged.
Oh my gosh.
So it's not a perfect science, but it's an interesting. It at least allows you to pause for a moment.
Right, right. I can see how those of you know, would be cumbersome, sort of like some of the filters that we have in our workplaces or filters that our children have in elementary school on their computers. Mm-hmm. But overall, a really a nice direction to take. And I also wanted to mention that, you know, with any sort of movement, there's always a backlash. So there's all this First Amendment movement that has gone awry, say, and therefore I've seen organizations popping up having, you know, respectful conversation, curated conversation that is face-to-face. But also, you mentioned in your book some programs or apps like Google's Perspective API, and then another one called Facilloscope. And so it's, you know, hosting better conversations. And how do those work?
So they're mostly in, I think, like a beta use at the moment. But my understanding of how they work is, you know, what I just described was how the Google Perspective API works, and also I think Facilloscope works that way as well. But then I think the idea is for individual websites, like news organization websites or any kind of like blog where people can comment, to then use that technology in their comment sections. And I think they can decide how they want to do that. And so the general idea isn't to shut people down or censor people, but to remind people, you know, give them sort of nudges. And so there's definitely debate about that, about whether, you know, whose job is it to do that and who literally is going to do that job at these organizations, and how people will respond to it. I've been looking for data and anecdotes on how Nextdoor's kindness reminders are working, and haven't found much yet. So we are still kind of in the early stages of this.
Caitlin, let's talk about loneliness and being socially isolated. Historically, and historically what I mean is before social media, loneliness and being socially isolated went hand in hand. And now we're finding that social media can alleviate loneliness in the short term, but in the long term, might have more challenges for social isolation. Sort of a complex topic. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. I think if you think about, you know, social media connects you to tons of people all over the world, and you can, you know, easily message people, easily share videos, text, photos, everything. But at a certain point, I think if you are spending a ton of time on it, it can start to feel isolating. So I've experienced this myself, you know, kind of mindlessly scrolling on Instagram and seeing all my friends, but then you start to see what people are doing without you, and you get, you know, FOMO, fear of missing out. And then you can, for younger kids, I know it's a big issue, FOMO. And then I was told by some young folks who I interviewed about something where people will aggressively like posts just to kind of bother you, so you get a ton of notifications. So there are bullying behaviors that happen on there as well. But I think that generally everything kind of gets flattened on social media. And even though you're consuming things that people are putting out there and you kind of feel like you're connected to other humans, There is this isolating effect where when you put down the phone, you know, you are still by yourself, and now you're more prone, depending on your personality, to, you know, be comparing yourself to what you just saw. So I think the research and, you know, psychology experts tend to say that it's not necessarily these products and tools themselves, but the way that we use them and the kind of personalities and behaviors we already have when we come to them that impact whether they make us feel lonely or depressed or anxious.
We post our podcast to our Facebook site, and because of Cool Science Radio, I had to work with Facebook a little bit. I don't use Facebook myself. Have I missed that wave completely, people moving towards Instagram? And what are some of the differences?
Between Facebook and Instagram?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the trend seems to have been more toward Instagram, but now I think as an Instagram person, I'm behind because the younger people are using TikTok and Snapchat more. But these other platforms are a lot more photo and video heavy than Facebook. And it's a little bit easier, from what I understand, to follow people and to block and delete comments and things like that on Instagram and these other platforms. Also, Snapchat is one of those platforms where your content disappears, you know, within 24 hours. And Instagram also has that capability in their stories section where you can put a video or a photo in it. It'll be gone in 24 hours.
Yeah, that's kind of nice. I've had this ongoing thing with Facebook where now I've removed it from my phone, and I really enjoy not automatically going to Facebook to check it if I don't know what else to do with my hands. And so I haven't missed that. And yet you really need to still use it for business purposes. And so that's kind of that conflict there as I see it.
Yes. And I experienced that as well. In the book, I write about how I had to have my husband change my password for me so that I would stop wasting time obsessively on Facebook. And then I deactivated for a while, but now I'm back because for work, I, you know, kind of feel beholden to it. I do think that seems to be changing. A lot of people seem to be moving away from it. Stephen King, the author, just made a big announcement that he was going to be getting off of Facebook. So I think we'll see.
There you have it. Yeah, I think a lot of people are disillusioned with it because of the whole meddling in our elections and the fake news. And we're becoming wise to it and seeing the reaction of Facebook, not moving quickly enough to sort of right the wrongs that have occurred.
Right. I think people don't feel that their data is safe. I've deleted most of my photos off of there, even though I'm on, and I don't really have much personal information anymore. Although I do, you know, as a millennial, I'm kind of a little bit dystopian in my thoughts about these things. But as I've been saying, you know, interviewing people and writing this book kind of gave me a sense of hope that that we don't necessarily have to settle for dystopia.
Before we let you go, I have to ask you about Ellie, the digital avatar that acts as a therapist. It's fascinating. Maybe you can just take a minute, and we're almost out of time, but maybe you can just tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. So Ellie, it's a piece of tech that has been developed at the VA along with some folks at the University of Southern California, and they will say that she is not a therapist because it's, you know, she hasn't gone to school and gotten her degree and everything. But the idea is that vets and active duty soldiers are able to discuss with this avatar, you know, their mental state. And they found in some research that they were more likely to admit to PTSD symptoms and other mental health symptoms to this avatar than they might be when they're filling out a required form or talking to a doctor. And so my understanding is that Ellie is kind of the way to get those conversations started. And then when people, you know, if they disclose that they have an issue, then they would be referred to a medical professional. But it's fascinating the way having that sort of barrier where this avatar is human-like, but you know she's not human, and both of those things together seem to make people more comfortable expressing these concerns that they otherwise might feel some shame about expressing.
So interesting. Well, the book is The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Our guest, Caitlin Ugalik-Phillips. Oh, you've really helped us understand a lot of things. And thank you, as you call yourself an old millennial. Yeah. I love that. So you're going to help us figure this out. Caitlin, thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.